are. Now please let us out. One more minute, I promise. I crouch, place my palms flat on the boulder, and give it a push. It's so heavy I can barely move it. I try again, this time gritting my teeth and grunting with exertion. The boulder doesn't budge. Using the flashlight, I scan the ground for anything that can help. I grab a rounded rock that had chipped off the crumbled wall nearby. Then I spot a fat branch on the ground that's almost as long as I am. It looks sturdy enough to be used as a lever, I hope. I shove one end of the branch as far under the boulder as it can go and place the rock under it a few feet away before grasping the other end of the branch and pushing downward. It does the trick, setting the rock rolling the tiniest bit. I drop the branch and run to the boulder, pushing again, continuing the momentum until it's past the door. All clear. The door flies open and the girls burst out. Sweaty and dirt-smeared, they suck in fresh air, stretch their limbs, give dazed looks to the sky. Without her glasses, Sasha is forced to squint. Her nose is swollen and colored a brutal shade of purple. Rust-colored flecks run from her nose all the way to her neck. Dried blood.
"Is it really night?" she says, with almost clinical detachment. Shock with a dash of hunger and dehydration thrown in for good measure.
Rather than hug her, I run my hands up and down her arms, checking for injuries. I feel stupid for not bringing food, or water, or a damn first aid kit. All I can do is use the hem of my t-shirt to wipe some of the blood from Sasha's face. "How long were we in there?" Miranda says as she spreads out on the ground, her arms and legs akimbo, panting with relief. "My phone died before noon. Almost a full day." Hearing that makes Crystal's legs buckle. She staggers a moment before plopping down next to Miranda. "Damn. Tell me what happened," I say, "from the moment you left the cabin."
"We came here to look for your friends," Crystal says. "It was Miranda's idea."
Miranda sits up, too spent to be ashamed.
"I only wanted to help. You were so upset last night. I could tell you needed to know what happened. And since this is where you found that diary, I thought there might be more clues here."
"Why didn't you say anything?"
"Because we knew you wouldn't have let us row here by ourselves."
I finish wiping Sasha's face. The dried blood leaves a dark red stain on my shirt.
"You came here, and then what?"
"Someone jumped us," Miranda says, fear peeking through her exhaustion. Tears cling to the corners of her eyes.
"Who?"
"None of us got a good look."
"Miranda and Crystal went inside," Sasha says, nodding toward the root cellar. "I didn't want to, so I stayed out here. But then someone came out of nowhere."
She croaks out a sob. It's followed by more words that tumble forth in a rush, that clinical tone now long gone.
"They punched me and my glasses fell off, and I couldn't see who it was, and then they shoved me inside and slammed the door."
"Someone followed them here, attacked, trapped them rather than outright killing them. It makes no sense. Unless whoever did it wanted them alive. Which means they might be coming back any minute now." Fear zips through me. I yank my phone from my pocket to see if I can call the police. There's no signal, which explains why Miranda couldn't do the same right after they were trapped. "We need to go," I tell the girls. "Right now. I know you're tired, but do you think you can run?" Miranda climbs to her feet and shoots me a worried look.
"Why do we need to run?"
"Because you're still in danger. We all are." A beam of light hits my face. A flashlight. Bright enough to both silence and blind me. I put my hand over my eyes, shielding them from the glare. Behind the flashlight, I can make out a silhouette. Tall. Masculine. The glare falls away. My vision blurs, eyes adjusting.
When they come back into focus, I see Theo, flashlight in hand, taking a step toward us.
Emma, he says, what are you doing here?
38. Seeing Theo here feels like a minor earthquake. The ground under my feet trembles, only it's me who's really trembling. A seismic shifting in my body I'm powerless to control. Because his presence can't be an accident. He's here for a reason.
What's going on? He says.
I'd ask you the same thing, I say, a catch in my throat. But I think I already know. He's come back for the girls. He attacked them, locked them away, waited until the dead of night to return. A chain of events I suspect happened 15 years ago with a different trio. My accusation, as misguided as it was, might have been correct. Truth disguised as a lie. I hate thinking this way. Of everyone in camp, he's the only one I truly hoped was innocent. But the suspicion refuses to leave, as uncontrollable as my quaking, exhausted body. I edge in front of the girls, shielding them from Theo and whatever he might try to do next. I slip a trembling hand through my flashlight's wrist strap, securing it. Although not much of a weapon, it'll do in a pinch, if it comes to that. I desperately hope it doesn't. Miranda, I say, with as much calm as I can muster. There's a canoe on shore in the same place we landed the other day. Take Sasha and Crystal there as fast as you can. If Sasha has trouble, you might need to carry her. Do you think you can do that?
Why? Miranda says. What's going on?
Just answer the question, yes or no. Miranda's reply is streaked with fear.
Yes.
Good. When you get to the canoe, row across the lake. Don't wait for me, not even a second. Just row as fast as you can back to camp.
Theo aims his flashlight at my face again.
Emma, maybe you should step away from the girls. Let me see if they're hurt.
I ignore him.
Miranda, do you understand?
Yes, she says again, more forceful this time, steeling herself for the sprint.
Good. Now go. Hurry!
That last word, and the desperate way I say it, gets the girls moving. Miranda bolts away, all but dragging Sasha behind her. Crystal follows, slower but just as determined. Theo makes a move to stop them, but I lunge forward, flashlight raised, threatening to strike. He freezes when I'm 2 feet away and drops his flashlight. He raises his hands, palms open. I don't lower my flashlight. I need to keep him like this, just long enough to give the girls a head start.
Don't you dare go after them, I warn.
Emma, I don't know what's going on.
Stop lying, I shout. You know exactly what's happening. What did you plan to do with those girls?
Theo's eyes go wide.
Me? What were you going to do with them? I've followed you here, Em. I watched from the lodge as you got into that canoe and rowed across the lake.
It's another lie. It has to be.
If you thought I was guilty, why didn't you tell the police?
Because, Theo says, I wanted to be wrong. As I did. All that guilt I'd felt about accusing him, all that shame and remorse, it was for nothing.
I need to know why you did it, I say, both now and back then.
I didn't. I lift the flashlight higher. Theo flinches.
Hey, let's talk about this, he says, without the flashlight.
I think you had the hots for Vivian, I tell him. You wanted her, and she rejected you. You got mad. You made her disappear. Natalie and Allison, too.
You're wrong, Emma, about everything.
Theo takes a step toward me. I stay put, trying not to show my fear. Yet my hand trembles, the flashlight's beam quivering skyward.
Since you got away with it once, I guess you thought you could do it again. Only this time you tried to make me look guilty. My bracelet in the canoe was insurance.
You're troubled, Emma, he says, carefully choosing his words, making sure not to offend me. You need help. So how about you drop the flashlight and come with me? I won't hurt you, I promise.
Theo risks another step closer. This time I take a step back.
I'm done being lied to by you, I say.
It's not a lie. I want to help you.
We repeat our steps, forward for him, backward for me.
You could have helped me 15 years ago by admitting what you did.
If Theo had turned himself in, then maybe I wouldn't have felt so guilty about what happened. Maybe I wouldn't have hallucinated the girls. Maybe I would have been normal. Instead, I spent 15 years blaming myself for what happened to them, I say, and I blamed myself for causing you pain.
Another step for Theo.
I don't blame you, Emma, he says. This isn't your fault. You're sick.
Another step for me.
Stop saying that!
But it's true, Em. You know it is.
Instead of one step forward, Theo takes two. I move backward, first shuffling, then turning around and running. Theo chases after me, catching up within seconds. He grabs my arm and jerks me toward him. I cry out, the sound streaking through the dark woods. I hear its echo as I raise the flashlight and swing it against Theo's skull. It's a weak blow, just enough to shock him into letting me go. I give him a shove, knocking him off balance, then I run again, this time in the opposite direction, back the way I came, toward the lake.
Emma! Theo shouts at my back. Don't!
I keep running, heart pounding, pulse loud in my ears. Trees and rocks seem to lurch at me from all sides. I dodge some, slam into others, but I don't stop. I can't. Because Theo's also up and running. His footfalls echo through the woods behind me, outpacing my own. He'll catch up sooner rather than later. Outrunning him isn't an option. I need to hide. Something suddenly looms before me in the darkness. The monolith. I run to it, swerving right until I'm at its northwestern edge. I shine my light over the rock wall, seeing the fissure that opens up a foot from the ground. The cave Miranda had crawled into. I drop to my hands and knees in front of it and shine the flashlight inside. I see rock walls, dirt floor, a dark recess that runs at least a few feet into the ground. A shimmer of cool air wafts out of it, and I let out an involuntary shiver. Theo's voice rings out from somewhere close, too close.
Emma? I know you're here. Come on out.
I flick off my light, drop to my stomach, and back into the cave, worried I might not even fit. I do. Barely. There's roughly 6 inches of space above me, and slightly less on each side. The sky outside the cave brightens. Theo's flashlight. He's reached the rock. I will myself not to breathe as I slide back even more. The cave floor feels uneven, like I'm on a slant, edging downhill. A flower of light blooms on the ground near the mouth of the cave. I hear the crunch of Theo's footsteps, the sound of his labored breaths.
Emma, he says, are you here?
I move back even farther, wondering how deep the cave goes, hoping it's far enough to escape the beam of Theo's flashlight if he aims it inside.
Emma, please come out.
Theo's right outside the cave now. I see his shoes, his toes pointed in the opposite direction. I continue to slide backward, faster now, praying he can't hear me. I feel water dripping down the cave walls. Mud starts to squish beneath me, gurgling up between my fingers. I'm still sliding, although now it's not by choice. It's because of the mud and the tunnel's slant, which turns sharply steeper. I dig my knees and the heels of my palms into the mud, hoping they'll act as brakes. It only sends me slipping even more. Soon I'm sliding fast, out of control, my chin leaving a groove in the mud. When I flick on the flashlight still around my wrist, all I see are gray walls, brown mud, the shockingly long path I've just traveled. Then the ground below me vanishes, and I'm suddenly in midair, dropping, helpless and flailing, my screams swallowed by their echoes ringing through the cave as I plummet into nothingness. 39. Water breaks my fall. I drop right into it, caught by surprise, unable to close my mouth before plunging under. Liquid pours in, choking me as I keep falling, somersaulting in the depths, the flashlight's beam streaking through the water, revealing dirt, algae, a darting fish. When I finally do touch bottom, it's a gentle bump, and not the life-ending crash against hard stone I expected. Still, it's a shock to my nervous system. I push off from the bottom as water continues to tickle the back of my throat. I gag, coughing air that bubbles past my face. Then I'm at the surface, my head emerging and water unplugging from my nostrils. I cough a few times, spitting up water. Then I breathe, long and slow inhalations of dank subterranean air. With the flashlight miraculously still dangling from my arm, I paddle in place, trying to get a sense of my surroundings. I'm in a cavern roughly the same size as Camp Nightingale's mess hall. The beam of the flashlight stretches over black water, damp rock, a strip of dryish land surrounding the pool in a crescent shape. The water itself takes up about half the cave, no larger than a backyard swimming pool. When I aim the flashlight upward, I see a dome of rock above me, dripping with stalactites. The cavern shape makes me think of a stomach. I've tumbled into the belly of a beast. A dark hollow sits in a corner where rock wall meets cave ceiling, the spot from which I fell. I sweep the flashlight up and down, trying to gauge how far I dropped. It looks to be about 10 feet. I swim forward, heading to the land that partially rings the water. The ground there is studded with pebbles, painted pale by the flashlight. I pull myself onto it and collapse, exhausted and aching. I reach into my pocket and optimistically search for my phone. It's still there. Even better, it still works. Thank you, waterproof case. The phone doesn't have any signal. Not that I was expecting one this far below ground. Still, I try calling 911 in case, by some small miracle, it actually goes through. It doesn't. I'm not surprised. I remember what Detective Flynn said about tracking someone's location using the GPS on their phones. I can't help but wonder if that still applies when the missing person is underground. I doubt it. Even if it's possible, such a thing could take hours, maybe even days, to pinpoint my location. If I want to get out of here, I'll have to do it myself. I aim the flashlight to the stretch of cave wall rising to the hole above me. It's steep, not quite a 90-degree angle, but mighty close. Before trying to climb it, I scan the rest of the cavern, looking for another way out. I aim the flashlight into every corner and dark cranny I can find, seeing nothing but more water, more rock, more dead ends. Scaling that wall is my only option. In desperation, I run to it, not pausing to look for places to grip. Instead, I leap onto the wall, clawing at rock, scrambling for outcroppings. I get about 3 feet before I lose my grip and fly backward, landing hard on the cave floor. I try again, this time making it 4 feet off the ground before getting bucked off. This time I land directly on my tailbone. Sharp pain shoots up my back, momentarily paralyzing me. Yet I make a third attempt, slowing down a bit, puzzling together the best places to grip and the right direction in which to climb. It works. I find myself rising higher. 6 feet. 7. When I'm about a foot from the tunnel that leads back outside, I realize there's nothing left to grasp. I reach up with my right arm, my palm smacking smooth rock that's cold and slippery. My left arm and shoulder bearing all that weight start to give out. My body droops. For a second, I dangle against the cave wall. Then I plummet back to earth, landing feet first, my right ankle twisting beneath me before buckling. I think I hear something snap, or maybe it's my imagination as I collapse into a pained heap. I scream, hoping it will take the edge off. It doesn't. The pain continues. So does the screaming. I look at my ankle and my foot, bent in a way it shouldn't ever be. There'll be no more climbing for me. That's when reality sets in. I'm trapped here. No one knows where I am. I'm now as lost as Vivian, Natalie, and Allison. 40. The flashlight dies shortly after 4 a.m. I know the time because I check my phone as soon as the dying beam flickers into nothingness. I regret looking, even as I'm comforted by the blue-white glow of the screen. Time continues to pass at an agonizing pace. It's as if the minutes last longer down here, stretching themselves until a single hour feels like 3. Wanting to preserve as much battery as possible, I shut off the phone and return it to my pocket. Then I sit in darkness so complete it feels like death. Nothing but black emptiness. I start to shiver, realizing how alarmingly cold it is down here. The pool of frigid water doesn't help. Ditto my wet clothes, which cling to my clammy skin. My body trembles, my teeth chatter. Yet none of that keeps me from dozing off as I huddle against the side of the cave, my knees pulled to my chest. Each blink in the darkness somehow ends with me falling asleep, only to bolt awake with a spasm of pain and a startled yelp. I'm beyond exhausted, if such a thing exists. I can't remember the last time I slept. I guess it was this morning when I woke up inside Dogwood. I turn on my phone and do another time check. 4:30. Fuck. I then look for a signal, once again finding none. Double fuck. I turn off the phone and count the passing seconds, saying them aloud in the echo chamber of the cavern. 1, 2, 3. When I blink, my eyes stay closed. 4, 5, 6. I'm suddenly too tired to speak, but the counting continues, now in my thoughts. 7, 8, 9. I sleep after that. For how long, I have no idea. When I awake, it's with another pain-filled jolt, me still counting, the number flying from my parched lips. 10. My eyes snap open, my sleep-blurred gaze landing on Vivian right in front of me. She reclines on the cave floor, her elbow bent, head propped up. It's how she liked to play two truths and a lie. She claimed the relaxed position made it harder to tell when she was lying.
"You're awake," she says.
"Finally." "How long was I asleep?" I say, now long past trying to cast her away through sheer force of will.
"An hour or so."
"Have you been here that whole time?"
"Off and on. I guess you thought you were rid of me."
"I certainly wanted to be." There's no point in lying to her. She's not real.
"Well, you're not." Vivian spreads her arms wide in mock delight. "Surprise!"
"You must find this amusing," I say, as I sit up and roll my neck until it cracks. "I'm a lost girl, too."
"You think you're going to die down here?"
"Probably."
"That sucks," Vivian says with a sigh. "Although I guess it makes us even, then."
"I wanted you to come back," I say. "I didn't mean it. and I'm sorry. Just like I'm sorry for locking the cabin door. It was a horrible thing to do, and I regret it every day. That's all truth, no lies.
I probably would have done the same thing, Vivian admits. That's why I liked you, Em. We were both bitches when we had to be.
Does that mean we still would have been friends if you hadn't disappeared?
Vivian twirls a lock of hair around her finger, giving it some thought.
Maybe. There would have been a lot of drama, lots of driving each other crazy, but there would have been good times, too. You being a bridesmaid at my wedding, drinking with me after my inevitable divorce.
She smiles at me, her kind smile, the one from the Vivian I thought of as a potential big sister. I miss that Vivian. I mourn her.
Viv, what happened to you guys that night? Was it Theo?
I can't believe you haven't figured it out yet. I left you so many clues, Em.
Why can't you just tell me?
Because this is something you have to figure out on your own, Vivian says. Your problem is that you're blinded by the past. Everything you need to know is right there in front of you. All you need to do is look.
She points to the other side of the cavern, where a snake of light crawls along the rock wall. Several more surround it, undulating like waves, making the dome of the cavern feel like a disco. Then it hits me. I can see. The darkness is gone, replaced by a warm light radiating through the entire cave. It comes quite improbably from the pool in the middle of the cavern. The light is a rich gold tinged with pink that makes the water glow like a hotel swimming pool. I check my phone, seeing that it's now 6, sunrise. The presence of light means one thing. There's another way out of the cave.
Vivian, I think I can get out.
She's no longer there, not that she ever truly was. But this time there's no lingering presence, no sense she could return at any moment. Vivian might be gone for good. I stand and limp to the water's edge. The light seems brightest to my right. Its undiluted glow suggests a straight path from the cave to the outside world, most likely an underwater tunnel connecting cave to lake. I slide back into the pool and face the light. Through the water, I see a glowing circle, roughly the same size as the tunnel I entered through. If it stays that same width across the entire length, I might be able to swim my way out of the cavern. I do a few laps around the pool, loosening up while testing out my injured ankle. It hurts, of course. It's also swollen, which limits movement. I need to fight through both. I have no choice. Properly warmed up, I line my body up with the tunnel entrance. I start shivering again. This time more from nerves than the chill of the water. I'm scared as hell and long for another way out of here. There isn't one. The only way out is through. I take a deep breath. I slip under the water. I stare at that golden pink light and start to swim toward it. 41. Swim. That's all I need to do. Swim and try not to think about how much my ankle hurts, or that the tunnel may slowly be closing in on me, or that I'm not even a quarter of the way through it yet. I need to do nothing else but swim, as hard and as fast as I can. Straight toward the light like the little girl in that movie that gave me nightmares when I was 9. Swim. Don't think about that movie and its creepy clown and fizzing TV, or how the silt from the lake water clouds my vision and stings my eyes. Just swim. Don't think about how the tunnel really is getting smaller, or how my shoulders skim the walls, scraping away mossy blooms of algae that make it even harder to see. Just fucking swim. Don't think about the algae or the shrinking tunnel, or how each flick of my right foot sends pain screaming through my ankle, or how the pressure is building in my chest like a balloon that's about to pop. I swim straight into the light, blinded by it, the glare forcing my eyes shut. My lungs scream, my ankle screams. I'm on the verge of screaming myself. But then the tunnel falls away, slipping from my shoulders like an unzipped dress. My eyes open to the sight of water everywhere. No cave, no walls, just blessed open lake glowing yellow in the ever-brightening dawn. I shoot to the surface and gasp, gulping down precious air until the ache in my lungs subsides. My ankle still hurts, as do my exhausted, limp-rag arms. Yet I have enough strength to stay afloat and keep my head above water. I might even be able to swim back to camp after some rest. Hopefully it won't come to that. Hopefully people are looking for me. Sure enough, I hear the hum of a motorboat in the distance. I rotate in the water until I can see it. A white skiff, one of two normally moored to Camp Nightingale's dock. Chet sits by the outboard motor, steering the boat across the lake. I swing an arm out of the water, waving to him. With what little air I have in my lungs, I scream his name. Chet! He spots me, his face bright with surprise to see me floundering in the lake. He cuts the motor, grabs a wooden oar, and paddles my way. Emma? My God, we've been looking everywhere for you! I resume swimming, he keeps paddling. Together we finally meet, and I latch on to the side of the boat. With Chet's help, I climb aboard and collapse inside, panting, too tired to move. "Did you find the girls?" I ask, panting out the words, still catching my breath. "Early this morning. They're dehydrated, hungry, and in shock, but they'll be fine. Last I heard, Theo was going to take them to the hospital." I sit up, buzzing with alarm. "Theo's back at camp?" "Yes," Chet says. "He said he found you with the girls and that you attacked him before vanishing in the woods." "He's lying." "That's crazy, Emma. You know that, right?" I keep talking, setting the crazy free. "He hurt those girls, Chet. He can't be near them. We have to call the police." I reach for my phone, amazingly still in my pocket and in working order. There's even a bit of battery left. I start to dial 911, but am halted by a shadow crossing the screen. Chet's reflection, as warped as a funhouse mirror. Gripped in his hand is the oar. I see that reflection, too. A faint glimpse of wood swiping across my screen right before Chet swings it into the back of my head. For a slice of a second, everything stops. My heart, my brain, my lungs and ears and eyes, as if my body needs a moment to figure out how to react. In that thin sliver of time, I assume that this is what death must feel like. Not a drift into deep slumber or a slow edge toward a warm light, just a sudden halt. But then the pain arrives, a screaming, nerve-jolting pain that floods every part of me, telling me I'm still alive. The dead don't feel this kind of pain. It hurts so much I envy them. Anguish takes over, rendering me helpless. My vision blurs, my head rings. I belch out a grunt of surprise as the phone springs from my hands and I collapse to the bottom of the boat. 42. I come to on the floor of the boat. I feel the scruff of fiberglass against my cheek, smell the fish stench, hear the echo of the water below. The boat is moving now. The outboard motor hums like white noise. Occasional sprays of lake water mist my face. I've landed on my side, my left arm pinned beneath me, my right one twitching slightly. My left eye is closed, smushed as it is against the floor. The lid of my right eye keeps blinking, the sky and clouds above flickering like an old movie. Rather than breathe, I hyperventilate. Short, gasping breaths that huff out air as quickly as I take it in. I'm still in pain, but it's no longer all-consuming. A steady drumbeat instead of a clash of cymbals. I'm surprised to learn that I can move, if I really put my mind to it. That twitching right arm bends, both legs stretch. I wiggle my fingers, marveling at the accomplishment. The clarity of my thoughts is another surprise. I know what's going on. I'm not struck dumb or deaf or blind. I assume Chet pulled back on the swing of that oar right before striking me, or else I'm just very lucky. Either way, I'll take it. When the sound of the motor ceases and the boat slows, I'm able to flip onto my back, pleased to learn that my left eye also works. I see Chet standing over me. The oar is back in his hands, although he switches between holding it too tightly and almost letting it fall from his grip. "I can't believe you had the nerve to come back here, Emma," he says. "Even though it was my idea, it still surprised me. Don't get me wrong, I'm glad you came back. I just didn't think you'd be that stupid." "Why?" I pause to take a dry mouth to swallow, hoping it will help get the words out. Each syllable is a struggle. "Why ask me back?" "Because I thought it would be fun," Chet says. "I knew you were crazy. Theo told me all about that. And I wanted to see just how crazy you'd get. You know, trap a few birds and put them in the cabin, a little paint on the door and an appearance at the window, a little peek in the shower." Chet pauses to give me a wink that makes my stomach roil. "I totally didn't expect you to run with it, though. I thought it would take a lot more work to make you look guilty. But all that talk about seeing Vivian, that alone made everyone think you'd snapped."
"But why?"
"Because of the real reason I wanted you back here. Girls from your cabin go missing, and to put you at the scene of the crime, I drop something of yours into an empty canoe with a broken pair of glasses and set it adrift. That bracelet of yours worked wonders, by the way. When I snapped it off your wrist outside the lodge, I knew it would be perfect." He flashes me a twisted smile. It's the grin of a madman, someone far more insane than I ever was. "After that, all I needed to do was delete any surveillance video of me near your cabin and change the file name of the one showing you leaving Dogwood yesterday morning. I'll let you in on a little secret, Em. The girls didn't sneak out 5 minutes before you woke up. They'd been gone at least an hour." I sit up, using my elbows for support. I tremble a moment before locking my arms and steadying myself. That small movement wakes me up a bit, gives me some lift. I hear the newfound strength in my voice as I say, "All that effort, I don't understand."
"Because you almost ruined our lives," Chet says with a snarl. "Especially Theo's. So much that he tried to kill himself. That's how much you fucked him up, Emma. When you destroyed his reputation, you destroyed ours as well. When I got to Yale, half the school wouldn't even talk to me. They saw me as the kid whose brother got away with murder because we're filthy rich. And we're not. Not anymore. All we have left is my mother's apartment and this godforsaken lake."
Even though my skull is stormy with pain, I finally understand. This is his revenge. An attempt to make me look as guilty as I had made Theo look. He wants me to live under the same cloud of suspicion, to lose everything.
"I didn't want to kill you, Emma," he says. "I would have much rather watched you suffer for the next 15 years. But the plan has changed. You made sure of that when you freed those girls. Now I have no choice but to make you disappear."
Chet grabs me by the shirt collar and hoists me off the floor. I don't struggle. I can't. All I can do is wobble precariously as he plops me onto the edge of the boat. The motion jars still more energy into me. Now that I'm off the floor, I can see we're in a part of the lake I don't recognize. A cove of sorts. Trees crowd the shore, ringing the water like walls of a fortress. Muted light seeps through them, doing little to burn away the fog that rolls across the water. Something sits in the mist, jutting out of the water a few feet from the boat. A rooster weather vane. It's the same weather vane I've seen in pictures, perched atop peaceful valley asylum. Only now it's edged with rust and crusted with barnacles. And the asylum it sits upon rests deep beneath Lake Midnight. I peer into the water, getting shimmery glimpses of its mud-caked roof. It's still here, right where it's always been. Only now covered by the lake. That part of Casey's story is true.
I had a feeling you'd recognize it, Chet says. You knowing about this place was another surprise. Little nosy Emma has really been doing her homework.
Judging from the ring of dried mud along the shore, I suspect the lake is usually high enough to completely cover the weather vane. It can be seen now only because of the current drought.
I found it when I was a teenager, Chet says. No one else knows it's still here. Not my mom, not Lottie. I guess they think old Buchanan Harris raised it when he bought the land. Instead, he just left it here and flooded the place. And now no one will know to look for you here.
My heart gallops, blood pumps to my brain, making me more alert as well as more afraid. Rather than silence me, the fear sparks my voice.
Don't do this, Chet. It's not too late.
I think it is, Em.
The girls didn't see you. They told me so. If you want me to tell the cops I did it, I will.
Words are my only defense. I have no strength to fight him off. Even if I did, I'd be no match against another swing of the oar.
No one will know you did it, I say. Just you and me. And I'm not going to tell anyone. I'll take the blame. I'll plead guilty.
Chet transfers the oar from one hand to the other. I think I'm getting through to him.
You want to see me suffer, right? Then imagine me in prison. Think how much I'll suffer then.
I'm hit by a flash of memory. Me leaving Camp Nightingale 15 years ago. Chet was there, calling after his brother, his face tear-streaked. Maybe that was the moment he decided he needed to get revenge. If so, I need to remind him of the boy he was before that.
You're not a killer, I tell him. You're too good of a person for that.
I'm the one who did something bad. Don't be like me. Don't become someone you're not.
Chet raises the oar, ready to bring it down once more. I lurch forward before he can do it, slamming myself into him. The strength comes out of nowhere, a coiled energy ignited by terror and desperation. It sends Chet stumbling against one of the boat seats. His legs catch on it, and he tumbles backward. The oar leaves his hands, clatters to the floor. I reach for it, but Chet's faster. He grabs the oar with one hand and slaps me with the back of the other. Spikes of pain sting my cheek, but the blow also zaps one last bit of adrenaline into me. Enough to let me scramble to the front of the boat and crawl onto the bow. Behind me, Chet's on his feet, oar in hand. He lifts it. He swings. I close my eyes, screaming, waiting for the blow to connect with my skull. Instead, a shot rings out, the sound careening across the cove. My eyes fly open in time to see the oar explode into a thousand splinters. I shut them again as wood sprays my face. I duck, trying to avoid it. The boat tips. I tip with it, tumbling backward, over the side of the boat and into Lake Midnight.
43. My fall through the water is brief, just a quick, disorienting drop before I slam into something a few feet from the surface. Wood, I think. Slick with moss and algae and 100 years of lake water rising and falling. A roof. As I'm realizing this, the wood beneath me buckles, giving way. Soon I'm falling again, still underwater, but now also surrounded by walls, encased within them. Peaceful Valley Asylum. I'm inside it, dropping from the ceiling to the floor below. I brace myself for another smash through it. It never comes. Instead, I bounce off the floor and drift upward. Faint light trickles through algae-streaked windows. It's enough brightness for me to see an empty room taken over by mud. Everything is tilted. Walls, ceiling, doorframe. The door itself has come off its hinges, and now sits askew, revealing a short hall, stairs, more light. I swim toward them, struggling to make it through the doorway, across the hall, down the steps. At the bottom, the front door gapes open. The door itself sits on the floor, all but blending in with the lake bottom. To my left is a sitting room. There's a hole in the wall where bricks and floorboards and scraps of wallpaper have tumbled out. A striped bass circles the room. I swim out the open door, passing from inside to outside, even though it's all part of the same watery landscape. Pain pulses through my body. My lungs burn. I need air. I need sleep. I start to swim upward, heading to the surface, when something catches my eye. A skull. Bleached white. Jaw missing. Eye sockets aimed at the sky. Scattered around it are more bones. A dozen, at least. I glimpse the arch of ribs, the curl of fingers, a second skull a few yards from the first. The girls. I know because nestled among the bones, shining faintly in the muck, is a length of gold chain and a locket in the shape of a heart. A tiny emerald sits in its center. Something enters the water behind me. I feel it more than see it, a shuddering of the lake. An arm reaches out and wraps around my waist. Then I'm tugged upward, away from the girls, toward the water's surface. Soon we're breaking through Lake Midnight. I see sky, trees, the camp's other motorboat bobbing on the water a few yards away. Within it stands Detective Flynn, his gun trained on Chet, who drops the decimated oar. And I see Theo, swimming next to me, arms still around my waist, lake water sloshing against his chin.
"Are you okay?"
he says. I think of Vivian, Natalie, and Allison lying directly below us. I think of all the years they spent down there, waiting for me to find them. So when Theo asks again if I'm okay, I can only nod, choke out a sob, and let the tears flow. 44. I sit in the front seat of Detective Flynn's police-issued sedan, the hospital a distant memory in the rearview mirror. I ended up being more bruised and battered than I initially thought. The doctor's diagnosis was startling. A concussion from the oar, a sprained ankle from the fall, lacerations, dehydration, a persistent headache. I ended up spending 2 days in the hospital. The girls were there for one of them. I shared a room with Miranda, and we spent that time complaining about our sorry states, giggling over the ridiculousness of it all, and gossiping about the handsome male nurse who worked the morning shift. Visitors streamed in and out. Sasha and Crystal from the room next door. Miranda's grandmother, a whirling dervish of Catholic guilt and smothering hugs. Becca dropped by with a book of Ansel Adams photographs, and Casey brought apologies for ever thinking I had tried to hurt the girls of Dogwood. Mark arrived with a stack of gossip mags and the news that he's back together with Billy the librarian. Even my parents flew in from Florida, a gesture that touched me more than I expected.
We plan to head back to Manhattan later this afternoon. Mark is going to tag along. It'll be an interesting drive for all parties involved. For now, though, I have unfinished business to attend to, as Detective Flynn reminds me. Here's what probably happened, he says. Based on what she wrote in her diary, Vivian, like you, assumed the worst about Peaceful Valley, Charles Cutler, and Buchanan Harris. She found the location of the asylum and took Allison and Natalie with her to get proof of its existence. From the way you described it, it's probably very easy to get disoriented down there. They went into the water, swam around the wreckage, never came back up. Accidental drowning. Just because I had assumed exactly that doesn't make dealing with it any easier. Not when I now know that Vivian died the same way her sister did. It's too tragic to comprehend. So there's nothing to suggest Chet killed them, I say, knowing it's impossible. Flynn shakes his head. He swears he didn't do it. I have no reason to doubt him. He was only 10 at the time. Besides, there's still quite a few bones at the bottom of that lake. It'll take a while to find them all. Until then, we won't know for certain it's your friends down there. But I already know. It was Vivian, Natalie, and Allison I saw in the depths of the lake. The locket was all the proof I need. Now just thinking about it causes grief to balloon in my chest. A common occurrence over the past 2 days. As for the second group of girls from Dogwood, Chet said he had no plans to hurt them, Flynn says. Seems to me like he didn't know what he was going to do. He was just running on anger, not thinking about the consequences. Where is he now? County jail for the time being. He plans to plead guilty to all charges tomorrow. From there, he'll probably be transferred to a mental health facility for an unknown amount of time. I'm relieved to hear it. I want Chet to get the help he needs, because I know a thing or two about seeking vengeance. Like Chet, I've felt the desire for revenge burn inside me. It's singed both of us. But I've healed. Not completely, but definitely getting there. And I guess I owe you an apology, Flynn says, for not believing you. You were only doing your job. But I should have listened to you more. I was so quick to think you did it because it was the easiest explanation. For that, I'm sorry. Apology accepted. We ride in silence until we reach the wrought iron gate of Camp Nightingale. When I straighten in my seat, Flynn looks my way and says, "Nervous to be back?" "Not as much as I thought I'd be," I tell him. Seeing the outskirts of camp brings a tumble of emotions. Sadness and regret, love and disgust, and brutal relief. The kind you feel when you learn the whole truth about something. The cheating spouse exposed, an official diagnosis. Having the truth revealed means you can finally start to unburden yourself of it. Flynn steers the car into the heart of camp. It feels as empty and silent as the morning I woke to find the girls missing from Dogwood. This time with good reason. All the campers, counselors, and instructors have been sent home. Camp Nightingale has closed early. This time for good. As sad as it is, I know it's for the best. There's too much tragedy associated with the place. Besides, Franny has enough to deal with. Lottie is outside waiting for me when the sedan pulls up to the lodge. Because I'm loopy from painkillers and my ankle is wrapped with a mile of ACE bandage, she needs to help me from the car. Before letting go of my hand, she gives it an extra squeeze, a signal that she has no hard feelings about what I've said. I'm grateful for her forgiveness. Flynn honks the horn and gives me a wave. Then he's off, steering the sedan out of camp as Lottie guides me to the lodge. Inside, there's no sign of Mindy. I'm not surprised. When visiting me in the hospital, Casey mentioned that she was returning to the family farm. She said it with relish, as if Mindy got exactly what she deserved.
If that means something better than being with Chet, then I'm inclined to agree.
I'm afraid there's not much time, Lottie says. Franny only has a few minutes before we need to go. The people at the jail are sticklers about visiting hours.
I understand.
I'm led to the back deck, where Franny rests in an Adirondack chair tilted to face the sun. She greets me warmly, clasping my hand and smiling as if the years of accusations and misdeeds between us mean nothing. Maybe now they don't. Maybe now we're even.
Dear Emma, how nice to see you up and about again.
She gestures to the floor next to her chair, where my suitcase and box of painting supplies have been placed.
It's all there. I made sure Lottie packed everything. The only things missing are Vivian's diary, which the police took, and the photograph she removed from the lodge. That deserves to stay with Lottie, don't you think?
I couldn't agree more.
Are you sure you don't want to have one last look around Dogwood? Franny asks. In case we missed something.
No, I say. I'm fine.
Dogwood is the last place I want to be. It's too full of memories, both good and bad. With all that's happened, and all I now know, I'm not ready to face them. The sight of those names carved into hickory and the sound of that creaking third floorboard would probably break me. Franny gives me a knowing look, like she understands completely.
I'm sorry I didn't visit you in the hospital. Under the circumstances, I thought it best to stay away.
You have nothing to feel sorry about, I tell her, meaning every word.
But I do. What Chet did is inexcusable. I'm truly, deeply sorry for whatever pain he caused. To you and the other girls in Dogwood. And please believe me when I say that I didn't know what he had planned. If I had, I never would have asked you back.
I believe you, I say. And I forgive you. Not that you did anything wrong.
You've been nothing but kind to me, Franny. It's me who should be begging for your forgiveness.
I already gave it, long, long ago.
But I didn't deserve it.
You did, Franny says, because I saw goodness in you, even if you never knew it was there yourself.
And speaking of forgiveness, I think there's someone else who has a thing or two to say about that.
She stretches out her hand, seeking help in getting out of her chair. I oblige and gently lift her to her feet. We lean against each other, wobbling in tandem to the deck's railing. Below is Lake Midnight, as beautiful as always. And sitting on the lawn, staring out at the water, is Theo.
Go on, Franny urges. You two have a lot to talk about.
At first, I say nothing to Theo. I simply join him on the lawn, my eyes on the lake. Theo is silent in return, for obvious reasons. I've now accused him twice. If anyone deserves the silent treatment, it's me. I glance at his profile, studying the scar on his cheek and a new mark on his forehead, a deep purple bruise where I had struck him with the flashlight.
I've caused him so much pain. Chet's actions aside, he has every right to hate me.
Yet Theo still made sure I made it out of the lake alive. Detective Flynn talked at length about how quick Theo was to dive into the water after me. Zero hesitation. That's how he described it. It's a debt I'll never be able to properly repay. I could sit here and thank Theo for hours, beg his forgiveness, or apologize so many times I lose count. But I don't. Instead, I hold out my hand and say, "Hi, I'm Emma." Theo at last acknowledges my presence with a turn of his head. Shaking my hand, he replies,
"I'm Theo. Nice to meet you.
It's all he needs to say. Theo shifts beside me and pulls something out of his pocket, which he drops into my hand. I don't need to look to know it's my charm bracelet. I can feel the chain curled against my palm, the weight of the three pewter birds.